She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. My name is Gina Murphy-Darling, your host for this next hour, and thanks for joining us. A quick shout out to one of our sponsors, the Fairfax Companies, true leaders in the business of sustainability. I invite you to check them out at thefairfaxcompanies.com for more information. We thank them for their support and for everything they do to make our community and our planet stronger and more sustainable. Thank you, Fairfax. So get ready to think. The name of our show today is Green Biz, the big green buzz. I've been waiting for this interview maybe for about 8 years. It's finally happening. I'm very excited to have as our guest Joel McCower. Joel is the chairman and executive director of Green Biz Group. He's producer of greenbiz.com and lead author of the annual State of the Green Business Report. He also hosts the annual Green Biz Forums, the global event series at Verge, and numerous other events. He's the author of more than a dozen books, including his soon-to-be-released in a number of days on June 21st, The New Grand Strategy. We're going to be talking all about that, and it's about restoring America's prosperity, security, and sustainability in the 21st century. And I'm hoping that at the end of the show, every one of our listeners goes to Amazon.com and puts in their order. Joel, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Gina. It's great to talk to you.
And I really have been waiting for about 8 years. I mean, if you're in the business of sustainability and spreading the word and don't know who Green Biz is, I think you could make the case that you're really not in the business of sustainability. So that is my high kudos and praise to you.
Very kind. Thank you.
And very true. I would like to spend most of the show talking about the new book because I would help with a subtitle called The Blueprint for How We Can Literally Become the Great America That We All Had Envisioned in Our Lives and Are Sometimes Doubting in These Very Challenging Days. But can we talk a little bit about Green Biz? Because it is where environmental responsibility meets profitable business practices, and I think that's a large part of your incredible global success and recognition. What was your mission and vision when you and Pete May started it over 10 years ago?
So Green Biz originated, keeps sort of multiple layers, that
right.
originated from a website I created to promote a monthly newsletter that I started in 1991 called the Green Business Letter. It was what we would now call a dead tree snail mail newsletter, 8-page monthly newsletter.
Like people read it.
People read it and went out to, mail by mail to a lot of major companies. And that came out of a book I had written right out of junior high school in the late 1980s. called the Green Consumer. I've been sort of looking at this field for over 25 years, and greenbiz.com was originally a nonprofit website launched in 2000, and when I met a guy in about 2006 named Pete May, who was came from the B2B publishing world. When I started this website, there was no business model for giving away information on the internet. And, of course, back then, that didn't stop a lot of people.
There was hardly the internet. I mean, I was alive at the time when, getting a home computer was a big deal. So go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt the flow. So on this journey, go ahead.
So, there was the dot-com boom that preceded the dot-com bust. So there was a lot of internet, a lot of companies being started, and I couldn't figure out what the business model was. So I did it as a nonprofit, and then I met this B2B publishing guy called Pete May, who's very successful, and we ended up turning it into a for-profit website. And so we started off as a media company to help. As a journalist, I always considered myself an information pack rat, but all of a sudden in the new digital age, suddenly I was a content aggregator. And so in that new role, I just wanted to create the mother of all websites on business and the environment. I was seeing this incredible revolution taking place that most of the companies that were in the middle of it didn't even see for themselves, let alone beyond that. And so I just really wanted to bring together a lot of what was going on, and that became a media company. And then we started adding events and reports, and we also have a membership group of sustainability executives from big companies that we bring together several times a year face-to-face for what we call peer-to-peer learning and what they tend to call group therapy. So it's really an interesting group of people to get to sit there and listen within what's called Chatham House Rule or off the record. The pain and suffering and the successes and aspirations of some of the world's biggest companies and how they're thinking about this. So I've been watching the world of business gradually move into this arena and integrate, as you say, environmental thinking with bottom line goals and corporate strategy, and today in many ways actually rethinking and reinventing their products and services and even their business model. So it's a really exciting area that's largely unknown to the public at large.
And it's one that to me is the, I don't know the exact words I want to use. It lends the critical component of what I call credibility for the people that talk about green not being good business. And what you constantly, consistently, and credibly address is you take it very responsibly that the environment does have to meet profitable business practices. I mean, it's certainly something I aspire to in my model of Mrs. Green's world. So it's, yeah, I get that part. So
yeah, I mean, the economy is a wholly owned subsidiary of the environment, and you know, they're inextricably linked. And what I love is I go to talk to business schools and others, and you know, I'll talk about what a company, that big company at McDonald's or a Walmart or a Nike or some, you know, is doing, and some really innovative thing that happens to be saving them a lot of money. And someone, you know, some smart kid will raise their hand at some point and say, well, you know, they're not really doing that for environmental responsibility. They're just really doing that for good, because it's good business.
Right, bottom line.
And to which I say, bingo, exactly. And first of all, it doesn't matter why they're doing it. The fact is they're doing it, and what their motivation is, whether it's to save the earth or get better return for their shareholders, you know, certainly nature doesn't care.
And I think the case can be made that without them, we cannot move the green needle forward. We need big business to get on board in record numbers so that the impact can be far-reaching and significant. So I'm with you. Like, don't beat up on a big business for the reasons they're doing something. Just hope they are. I mean, Walmart's a perfect example for moving forward organic milk. I mean, once they, you know, decided they were going to do it because of consumer pressure, that needle moved forward fairly quickly. So a couple of...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I was going to say there's a tendency to be, you know, critical that, and this is why companies are walking way more than they're talking. They're doing a lot more than they're saying. And one of the reasons is that the minute you stick your neck out on this stuff, you tend to become a target. And it's just easier to do this stuff and, as you said, gain the business benefits, and not necessarily try to score reputational points, because it's, you only get into trouble. So as a result, and it's kind of sad in a certain way, but it is what it is. Companies are just doing this stuff because, like I said, it makes good business sense, and you know, and maybe they'll talk about it in a sustainability report. But as a result, the public doesn't get to really appreciate all that's going on out there.
And the examples that can be used where, you know, the public, to me, always underplays their hand in terms of their power. An example to me is Whole Foods and their commitment to more and more and more organic produce, not being able to even meet the supply, and all kinds of creativity is coming from that in terms of subsidizing organic farms, the conversion of, you know, big ag farms to more organic. So there is a public role there that I talk about a lot. Wake up and realize that you have some power and we can defeat things like the DARK Act. But a philosophical question somewhat is, you have really unprecedented success. And I don't say that to blow smoke. You've had measurable global impact on businesses, thought leaders, policymakers, certainly on the media, I can speak for that, and around the world. When you did decide to take the next step with Pete, Did you have a vision that this is what you could create and the kind of impact you could have from the start?
I wish I could say yes. There's an old saying in entrepreneurship that, you know, if your business ends up looking like your business plan, you did something wrong. We didn't know exactly where we were going. We certainly didn't know that the market for advertising would pretty much collapse across all media, and therefore that to make a living as a media company was not going to happen. And so, we saw a little of that happening, but more important, we just saw an opportunity to not just be a communicator, but to be a convener and curator of content for in-person, you know, live events, and started building the event business, which is now the biggest part of what we do. So I can't say that we saw that. We actually had some other ideas of things we thought we were going to build, some networking platforms and some other things that turned out to be not as easy to do or didn't have a viable business model. So, we didn't know what we were doing, but we just, you know, this is sort of a follow your passion and have the benefit of I have two great partners. Now, Pete May is one of them, and a guy called Eric Farrow, who comes from the big tech events world and has built some very big conferences, and, you know, have the benefit of people who actually know how to build things. I'm never know how to describe myself either as a entrepreneur cursed with a journalism streak or a journalist cursed with an entrepreneurial streak, but I'm not necessarily the business builder. I'm the one who sort of looks at where the world is going and how to tell those stories.
So the important part for me in that is the constant evolution and being at the cutting edge of where you are in terms of, you know, Verge. You didn't have Verge when you first started. And I think people in my neck of the woods are looking, and we are looking at you to do the work, and then we can get the word out about the important work. And it's critical, because we're not Green Biz, but we certainly have a role to play. Mm-hmm. I always want to know, you have a team, an incredible, stellar team of qualified people, diverse, and on any given day, you have a myriad of choices on what topics to cover, right? Water to energy to buildings, sustainable transportation. How does that process work? I always want to know the inside edition questions. How do you decide what's going to have reach, what's going to have impact, what's going to influence the decision makers? How do you do that?
You know, it's and you know this, Gina, it's equal parts art and science. I've always thought that, first of all, and this is true whether it's for a magazine or a website or a conference series or any number of things, that to succeed, if you're putting out something on a regular basis, or daily, weekly, monthly, whatever, that you want to give the audience some combination, let's say 50-50, but I don't actually know the exact percentage, of, you know, half of what they were expecting and half of what they weren't expecting. And so that's what's sort of fun. The fun part is, what weren't they expecting? What, you know, what didn't they see coming? What were they saying? Oh, my God, I never thought about that. Or that's, you know, who'd have thunk that, you know, this company would be doing that kind of thing, or that this market would be heading in this direction. There's just every week or two or whatever, there's just all these who'd have thunk moments in
it's true.
I was like,
it's so,
you know,
true.
Who'd have thunk about Walmart or, you know, Barclays Bank or, you know, Nissan or whatever it is, you know, the things they're doing. Who'd have thunk, just looking at some stories recently, that the head of BlackRock, one of the largest private equity firms, would be berating the Fortune 500 CEOs about short-termism and ignoring the risks of climate change to shareholders, let alone, of course, to the planet. And, you know, and just, you know, who'd have thunk? And it's really kind of cool. And so it's really fun for us to find those. And, of course, you know, there's incoming, there's organizations that are, you know, pitching us, but there's also the relationships we have, as I said, you know, first of all, with these 80 companies that we get to sort of an inside look at, but, you know, hundreds of others we've known over the years. And sometimes they come to us with, you know, some really interesting stories. But the other part of it is that we think is interesting, and this has been underlying the editorial philosophy here at Green Biz Group, which is that the what of sustainable business is interesting, but it's the why and the how that is all the value and makes the story a green biz story. So a lot of companies, you know, tell us, hey, we did this and we did this and we just published this, we committed to that, and, you know, we just joined this, and they think that's news. And that's a what story, and those are, you know, sometimes kind of interesting. But I tell my editor, my editorial team, to, you know, if, to the extent you, you know, someone gives you a press release, put the word, with the word why or how in front of it. So why Nissan just hired their first sustainability head, or, you know, how Unilever is measuring the growth of sustainability, the growth of revenue through, you know, in terms of how it relates to their sustainability commitments, or whatever it is. And I think it's that, you know, there was a saying back in the dot-com boom that we were talking about before, in the early days of the internet, the World Wide Web, that content is king. Right, you may have heard that or remember that.
Adage, still
that,
you hear know, it.
He or she that has content is going to make all the money. Well, it turns out that unless you're Disney or, you know, a few other heavy, you know, really successful content companies, content is cheap and ubiquitous, and nobody's, you know, really made a lot of money on that. But it's context. It's the companies that make sense out of all this stuff. And, you know, think Google, think eBay, think Amazon, and, you know, those are just the big ones, and, you know, thousands of other organizations that have helped sort things out, whether it's iTunes or whatever, give us access to things and understand how the, you know, how to make sense of this massive world of information. Context, it turns out, is king. So we try to bring context, not just content, to our readers.
And I don't really think I've ever, in 8.5 years, heard it articulated that way. Maybe my friend Seth Godin might have written on that quite a bit about the making it relevant, you know, build your tribe, and there's a lot of credibility that goes along with that and responsibility. Before we go to our first break, I want to ask this question fully, and then we'll talk about the book, because to me, the book that is coming out, you know, I like I said, my subtitle would be The Blueprint for Regaining Our Greatness. It's quite a it was a surprise to me. I'll just say that it's not what I thought the book was going to be about, and it's so relatable and on, but I want to talk to you about the topic of methane and the cows, because I really enjoyed the movie Cowspiracy. I interviewed one of the producers. I got an inside look at what it took for them to get Leonardo DiCaprio to endorse the movie as the executive producer for Netflix. I mean, it was really impressive to me of what the critical fact-checking had to go on before Leo put his name to it. And what I have found is that a lot of well-respected environmental organizations and thought leaders aren't really talking about the cows, about methane's significant contribution to greenhouse gas emissions, and more importantly, or all related, the devastation of our remaining rainforest, which is how my journey got started deep in the jungle in Peru. Well, your team at Green Biz is talking about it. At the end of May, you put an excellent blog post out. It was Christina McFarquhar, I hope I'm saying her name right, who's an analyst with the Global Canopy Program's Drivers. She wrote a piece, Why Cows Are the New Palm Oil for Retail Supply Chains. And the subtitle was, you know, retailers are far more active in scrubbing deforestation out of their palm oil supply chains than cattle. This is what the research shows. Can you talk about that? Go ahead.
I mean, this is part of a larger thing that's going on, which is that, you know, back in the early days, and, you know, 15, 20 years ago of the environmental movement, you know, it was, you know, you go into a rainforest and you chain yourself to a tree or live in it, or,
right,
you know, or a fence or something. And that worked to a point, except eventually you know, you need to leave the tree or the fence or something. You can only do that for so long, and then the bulldozers or whatever come in. And so the activist movement figured out pretty, you know, early on that really this, if you threaten the brand equity of companies, whether it's Staples and Office Depot or Exxon or McDonald's or Starbucks or Nike or whoever it is, at that end, they will then put pressure on their suppliers, because, you know, all of these companies have these supply chains. They may have thousands, even tens of thousands of suppliers, and they may be 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 layers deep So by the time you get a Big Mac,
right,
it may have gone through half a dozen different hands.
Lots of changes.
through ranchers and feeding lots and feedlots and
you're going to have to hold that
slaughterers and hold it. Anyway.
We'll finish up with that when we come back. I really want to make it all about the new grand strategy. Everybody, stay here with us. More from Joel McCower.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Pacific Time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmerglass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. And now, more with Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for joining us. I am Gina Murphy-Darling, the host of Mrs. Green's World. Joining me for this hour is Joel McCower. He is the founder of GreenBiz.com, an award-winning journalist, best-selling author, global speaker on sustainable business and clean technology, and as he says on his Twitter page, blah, blah, blah. So we know he has a great sense of humor. That just really cracked me up. I'm like, okay, that like made me totally relax. I've been looking forward to this so much, and I'm like, this guy is hysterical because you don't care about that. You care about the message. So that was pretty funny. I love it. I might do that in my Twitter page. It really made me laugh.
Go for it.
So we're talking about methane cows, everything.
Yeah.
It's like it's complicated. That's what you're saying. It's really complicated.
Yeah,
not a silver bullet answer.
But what I was saying is that if you take on the chains and their brands, then they'll fight the fight for you, and that's what's happening here. And so we're seeing that now, with the palm oil issue and the rainforest devastation has been going on for a long time, and a lot of companies have been taken on at the brand level. And we're also seeing that now with cows and methane. It's not just about eating beef and the amount of water and energy and fertilizer and everything that goes into that. It's what beef produces or cows produce. It's really complicated. And the whole quest of environmental, whether they're activists or concerned citizens or proactive companies, is where are the insertion points? Where are the critical levers that you can push or pull or press or whatever to make change at the scale and speed? It's not just there's a lot of small incremental change that's being passed off as sustainable business, and it's all good, but it's not good enough.
It's not going to cut it.
And that it doesn't really address the scale, speed, and scope of the challenges we're facing.
It's just not going to cut it. And I just, how do you do this, what I do every day, what you do every day, and kind of you want to sound the alarm and yet inspire people to action, not shut them down because they're so scared. So it's a daily challenge. So let's talk about your book, because it's, I am a person that has been on this journey from day one because of my heart and my passion and my protection of Mother Earth. And this book could be pivotal for our country if it's accepted that way. And hopefully you can check out my reputation. I don't say that lightly. The book really had me from the introduction, from the prologue, because of it sucked me in. And to be honest, I'm like, okay, great. Here's a how-to book. And I was underlining. I have tons of yellow stickies. On my iPad, because I got it there, and you know how you can put a little tag on it. But anyway, the name of the book is The New Grand Strategy, Restoring America's Prosperity, Security, and Sustainability in the 21st Century. It was co-authored by Mike Mickleby, I believe that's how you say his name, and Patrick Daugherty. And the story is compelling, because when I was reading it, I'm like, okay, so this is how it started with Mark and Patrick. Where did Joel come in and how? So can you kind of do a set the stage for, be the prologue for this part of the introduction? It's an incredible story.
Yeah, thanks. First of all, the book is A Business Plan for America, born at the Pentagon that embeds sustainability as a national strategic imperative. That sounds like, wow, what?
And I can't get that down. I mean, that's a really great Twitter quote. If I was at a Congress, I'd be dying to type fast enough to say, okay, here's what he said. You're going to have to send me that soundbite.
Well, you recorded this, so you can get, you can get it. But
I'll
that's the elevator pitch. So in 2009, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, a guy called Mike Mullen, who was appointed by George W. Bush, this is now early months of Obama's first term, called to the Pentagon a Marine colonel named Mark Puck Mickleby. Goes by Puck not because he's a Shakespearean actor, but because he's from Minnesota and played hockey. And a Navy captain called Wayne Porter to the Pentagon and installed him in an office just down the hall from him in the E-Wing and the highest profile part of the Pentagon, and asked them to create a narrative for America's future. Not a military strategy or an intelligence strategy. And I interviewed Mullen last year for this book, and I basically asked him, he's now retired, and I said, what were you thinking? And he said, well, you know, I didn't have, no one would tell me what the vision was for America, about what America wanted to be in the world, other than some platitudes, you know, freedom and justice and peace, freedom and American way, or, you know, low gas prices and all this kind of stuff. But nobody had a real vision. I didn't know what my 1.5 million men and women out there were fighting for. And I really wanted a vision of the world, of the role America wanted to play in the world and all of that. So he brought in these two strategic thinkers, Puck and Wayne, and they emerged a couple months later with a 30 or so page paper that called for a strategy, a narrative of America that based around sustainability. Now, this is not just environmental, do-goodism, sustainability. They define sustainability as an organism's ability to remain diverse and productive over time. An organism's ability to remain diverse and productive over time. And diversity goes to resilience, which goes to security. Productivity goes to growth, which goes to prosperity. And security and prosperity are America's enduring values for 240 years. That's kind of what the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, has been about, is creating a world where we can be prosperous and secure. And, you know, there's lots of other things under that. You know, the preamble of the Constitution articulates them, but so that was the basis, and they actually looked at, you know, called for dusting off a tool called grand strategy, which is something that we have done, used throughout our history, America's history, to take on the big challenges of the day. It's a way of aligning our economy and our foreign policy and a number of things to do things like take on fighting fascism or containing the communists. We knew we didn't want to take the Soviet Union on the battlefield, so we created the strategy called containment, where we would outcompete them economically and contain them militarily. And, you know, it led to everything from the moonshots in math in school to Vietnam and a lot of other things. But ultimately, you know, it worked. And the problem is that ever since they lowered the hammer and sickle on the Kremlin for the last time on Christmas Day 1991, we've been operating off that same playbook. We haven't had a new strategy. And so this Marine colonel and this Navy captain said that, you know, we should think of sustainability as the organizing principle for prosperity and security. So the Pentagon didn't know what to do with it. The paper got published by the Woodrow Wilson Center. Puck realized that this was his future, and it was never going to happen in government. So he retired after 28 years in the military, a fighter pilot over Bosnia and Iraq, a real cred, amazing Marine. And he found the only other guy in Washington who was thinking about grand strategy, something that sort of nobody's really thought about since Eisenhower administration, a guy called Patrick Doherty, and they ended up forming an institute at a Case Western University in Cleveland. Well, I met Puck on stage, basically, at one of our events. I talked with him briefly on the phone, but we did a 30-minute interview at one of our Bridge conferences in 2013, and I was just blown away, and it was for a number of reasons. It was this Marine, you know, self-deprecating, nose-picking Marine. What do I know? And then he'd say some brilliant stuff. But he got sustainability in a way that, you know, some of my most ardent environmental friends or some of the most proactive businesses that we know didn't really understand in terms of how it fit in with the economy and resilience and security and a whole bunch of other things. And as I got to know him and got to understand their work, I was not looking for anything to do. I was not looking to write another book. I've written a bunch of them. But a couple years ago, I sat him down to Puck and Patrick, and I this is actually what I said. I said, I'm biting my hand as I'm saying this, but you guys need to write a book, and I kind of know what that book wants to be. And so that's the book that it actually just came out last week. And June 14th is the pub date. And so it's out and about. And so we took this idea and we built it out. And so you know, really quickly, what this is about is and as we fleshed out this grand strategy, the grand strategy is about letting the economy do the heavy lifting in terms of creating smart growth at home, which translates into smart power abroad. And in this case, they said, well, what is the big global challenge of the day? And we said, well, it's global unsustainability. And it's things like not just the environment, although ecological depletion is one of them, but so is the rapid economic inclusion of 3 billion middle-class consumers over the next couple decades. It's about the resilience deficit of our infrastructure and supply chains, and it's about the fact that almost all the world's big economies in Europe and Asia and North America are propped up by monetary policy, the Federal Reserve and things like that, and not by consumer demand, which is traditionally how we've built strong economies and strong countries. So we laid out this plan of what would a new grand strategy be for America that would sustainability center, and it's letting the economy do the heavy lifting. And it's about tapping into three massive pools of demand. We can talk about these, so I'll just name them right now. Walkable communities, regenerative agriculture, and resource productivity. And so we lay out what this looks like and how we pay for it and where the leadership would come from, and a number of things, and that's what the book is about and how that leads to, and I'd love this construct, prosperity, security, and sustainability.
You can't, one of the things you said that struck me is, you know, it's kind of like a business plan, and what I just want to interject in that is, for our listeners, maybe yes and maybe no in terms of what the average reader that doesn't have all of the tools, the expertise, the background, the knowledge may not bring to the table is what I call its readability and relatability. So it's not a bunch of facts and figures and grids and charts and, you know, projected growth. It's about steps for creating a sustainable and socially just planet. I mean, that's it, maybe I've been searching for this in terms of the, you know, the nexus of what is it going to take. It crystallized it for me. Maybe it's my business background, my entrepreneurial background, I don't know, but it's so much more, and it really gives us the tools that we need to get from here to there. I mean, it does.
I mean, it's more than tools, Gina. It actually doesn't get down to the, you know, step one, two, three,
right,
as much as we could.
Yeah.
But what really excited me about this and why I, you know, sort of pushed a lot of things aside and carved out a year or so to write this book with my two co-authors was, and this is what I think, you know, compelled me when I first met Puck and then later Patrick. One of the things I've been talking about and for a decade or more, I think this is my last book, which was 2008, I think I wrote about this. We don't have any leaders, business, political, cultural leaders, who can tell a compelling story of what happens if we get things right. You know, I mean, we know what happens if we get things wrong.
Yes.
Thank you, Al Gore. Thank you, Bill McKibben. I mean, thank you, Al Gore and Bill McKibben. We, for sounding the alarm and showing what's real. But we haven't had anyone tell a really compelling story that's about, well, you know, job creation, economic development, and food security, energy security, water security, housing security, personal security, national security, and ultimately public health and community resilience. And we can talk about any of those things. And to the point where someone might say, or you might, or any of your listeners might say, well, if that's possible, why wouldn't we do that? And these guys had that vision, and together we built it out, fleshed it out, and took it to a whole new level in the form of the book.
And what you did in the form of the book is you address what I call, it says it, I think, in the book, the exact words, it's a rare case of bipartisanship. The disconnect is not there in this book. You can't smell it, you can't see it, you can't feel it. It's about America and Americans and about leadership. And that's
and one of the things that drew me to this and what I realized as we were sort of in the middle of this is that this grand strategy, this vision that we lay out in the book is really the best of both worlds, which is to say it's a somewhat progressive, what might call a progressive agenda around environmental responsibility and social justice and economic justice and a whole bunch of things, as well as, you know, just community, you know, growth and resilience and social cohesion and all that, done in a very conservative approach, which is by business, for profit, and Washington could lead, follow, or get out of the way. This is not a book about national leadership. It's why we don't need to fix Washington before we can fix the country.
I love that. It says that. No, we can't wait for them. It's never going to happen.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we have a book, we have a chapter sort of three-fourths of the way through the book called Waiting on Washington, which
right.
is things that Washington could do if, you know, if it actually did things.
The political
and
will.
If it had leadership, political will, and all that, things it could do to move this agenda along. But the next chapter, chapter 9, is called Not Waiting on Washington.
Right.
It's why we don't need to do those things in order to take on this grand strategy.
And something happened for me when I read that and when you said that. It's almost a switch on, if we think about it, a lot of big business has driven some of the major, in my opinion, catastrophic policies in the, you know, in our country today. Big business drove those decisions, got stuff in the Farm Bill, got, you know, natural gas companies to be exempt from the Clean Water Act. I've got a lot of those precious jewels, you know, stuck away. But what this says is that same power can be used for the greater good and to create a sustainable planet. Agreed? It's the flip side.
Well, yeah, I mean,
use that power eventually to shift the planet.
Yeah, I mean, that's been my whole world for the last 25 plus years, and that's what Green Biz is all about. And it's about the power of business to affect positive change and do it in a way that aligns with core business values and strategy, and that's what we've been reporting on day in and day out. And this is a much bigger vision of that, showing how, and it's not just in Green Biz, we tend to focus on the big companies. This is actually about both big companies, but it's really about local communities, including the big companies that operate there, local government, local communities, regional communities, how they, and with academic local universities and healthcare institutions, and how communities come together to build their economies in a certain way, and how that ramps up to the national level. There's actually a top-down and bottom-up approach to this grand strategy, and we lay them both out. And ideally, they would both happen, but if the top-down stuff doesn't happen, we show how this is already beginning to happen, or at least being modeled throughout the country in lots of different ways, in agriculture, in communities, and in company supply chains, and factories. And so what's really compelling about this, Gina, what I really, is that this is a big vision. Yes, it's, requires some leadership and cooperation, yes. But we've done this before. We know how to do this. This is a quintessentially American way of taking on the big challenges. We've done this throughout our history. We just, nobody's been thinking in these terms for at least a generation, and that's what we tried to lay out in the book, is what would this look like, and who would do this, and what the possible happy outcomes can be.
And I agree, and I think that is like the story of America, and when we come back, we have to take another quick break, but when we come back, I would like you to address in that vision, in that dream, in that opportunity, how much do we have to, as a U.S. population, kind of expand our worldview? We talk about, you know, the good old days and when America was great in the 21st century, blah, blah, blah. But sometimes I think we suffer from what I call extreme myopia, not looking around at what's going on with our neighbors, you know, the billions of people that don't have access to clean water and electricity and all of that. So how much do we have to expand our worldview to become that leadership role that we so, you know, we so rightly have had and so rightly can do? So let's talk about that when we come back, and a lot more about the book. Everybody, please stay with me. Joel McCower, founder of Green Biz. We'll be right back.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody. I am Gina Murphy-Darling, and you are listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. Thanks for being with us. The name of our show today is Green Biz, the Big Green Buzz. For almost the past 10 years in this capacity, Joel has been leading the movement through the vehicle Green Biz, consistently creating a big green global buzz about pretty much any topic where environmental responsibility meets profitable business practices. We're pleased to have him on our show today. Joel is the chairman of, you know what happened? You're not going to believe this, but it's okay. Joel is the chairman. I got a pop-up from what I'm reading, where I'm reading it. It's so annoying. We're pleased to have as our guest today, Joel McCower. He is the chairman and executive editor of the Green Biz Group, producer of greenbiz.com, and lead author of the annual State of Green Business Reports. And, you know, I gloss over these, but listeners, check it out. I have links. I have read so much of what Green Biz has produced for all the world to see. He hosts the annual Green Biz Forums, which it's on my bucket list, Joel, trust me. The Global Event Series Verge and many other events. And we're talking about the new book, I pre-ordered mine June 14th. It's, you know, when you could get it. It's the new grand strategy, Restoring America's Prosperity, Security, and Sustainability in the 21st Century. And I hope you will go for it. And I was asking you about America and the worldview, and that specifically came from chapter 3, which I loved, Unlocking the Next Boom. And I just like to read just a little bit of the beginning of that chapter. The single question facing Americans today is not how to strengthen the middle class or preserve American freedoms, though both are essential outcomes of any grand strategy. The core question is, what is America's role in the world? What strategy should replace the remnants of contaminant and ensure prosperity and security in the 21st century? So my prequel to that is, how do we do as Americans with a worldview and that myopia that I so lovingly refer to?
Yeah. Well, you know, our worldview since 9/11 has been pretty threat-centric. Yes. And, you know, we've spent so much of the first decade of this century focusing on Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Afghanistan and all of that, and we have trillions of dollars in debt to show for it. And a lot of the rest of the world has been focused on economic opportunity that's, you know, part of the growth of China and Asia and India, and as well as the emerging threats from climate change and some of the opportunities from how the new technologies can help solve that. And so, you know, my co-author, Mark Huck Mickleby, the former a retired Marine colonel, said, look, I didn't spend 28 years in the military for us to be the land of threat and risk. This is the land of opportunity, damn it. And we're not taking advantage of the opportunities that, by the way, if we take advantage of them, would reduce the threat and risk we all perceive, you know, around the world. And make no mistake, nobody's saying that we shouldn't be, you know, watching out for bad guys and taking them out when we can or need to, and that's important. There'll always be bad guys and, you know, we need to be as vigilant as ever about those. And the world's gotten much more complex. But there's also, you know, the worldview doesn't extend much outside of our borders. So we're not looking at, you know, how almost a billion people are suffering from chronic hunger and 2 billion are either over or undernourished, just to say they're malnourished or overweight or obese. We don't look at a fifth of humanity live in areas of water scarcity and another 500 million people are approaching this situation. You know, we don't look at the fact that roughly the population of India, about 1.1 billion people, lack access to electricity and on, and that, you know, cities are struggling to handle their infrastructures, the influx of people. And to say, okay, well, that's them, and, you know, we're us, and, you know, why is that important? Because we are all on this planet together, and the resources that we need, that we see this in Europe now with the migrant crisis, immigration crisis across borders. We're seeing this, you know, it's the resource wars for water and minerals, and we've seen this in the past with struggles around energy, access to energy across borders. This is a very interconnected world, and this is a world that wants what people want. And so if we don't pay attention to that, we're going to find ourselves on the short end of the stick. And the other part of that is that traditionally, and I know a lot of people who aren't Americans, you know, sort of don't love this view, but it's true that the world has looked to America for leadership in the past.
Yes.
And if you think about it now, what's the leadership we're showing? And, you know, and one of the we have a prologue, but the first sentence of the first chapter is, what does America stand for? You know, besides freedom and all that, but what do we stand for? In other words, and what do we want the world to see us as, let alone how do we want to see ourselves? And I don't think we haven't had an adult conversation about that in America. And by the way, 2016 election year, we should be having that adult conversation. There's no better time and more important time
and
to be having that.
We're not.
And so far. So, you know, our hope, and, you know, someone asked me, what's your aspiration for the book? And my aspiration is that it helps, you know, helps start a conversation that we're not yet having about America's future.
And a part of that, and it is addressed in the book, and you touched on it briefly, is that I'm very involved in Local First, in building social capital locally. Big fan of David Corton's, you know, Change the Story, Change the Future.
Sure.
But the mindset is something that this book invites us to do, because I think of us as regional in terms of our business and the corridors we're connected to, being so close to Mexico and blah, blah, blah. But as Americans, this book invites us to recognize the world is going regional. There are regional scale economies. We're all connected. Can you talk about that a little bit? It's such an important concept to grasp as we go into this new strategy that I'm hoping you're creating another worldwide buzz.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we can do regions at any scale, but so for, you know, the, you know, in agriculture, for example, you know, we look at bread baskets and, you know, but it's really at the regional scale that we can look at agriculture in a much more sustainable, regenerative way. And this is just within the U.S. So, for example, Indiana, which is one of the most agriculturally rich environments, imports 95% of the food it consumes, even though it's, you know, pretty much an agrarian state. But, you know, that's just and if you look at that, there's a regional food revolution, and there's also, but beyond that, you know, the regional, we're talking increasingly, and we're writing a lot about this on dreambiz.com, about the circular economy. And in fact, you know, how do we, you know, so it's more than recycling, it's how do we create products and systems of commerce that keep the molecules in play consistently over and over again. And all the circularity is regional, to paraphrase Tip O'Neill. That, you know, we're really looking at regional economies, whether that region is, you know, the San Francisco Bay Area where I live, or the Northern California, or whether it's, you know, and so even within our country, there's a lot of that. But also, you know, we look at economies. We've seen, you know, NAFTA and ASEAN and in Asia and the European Union. And so we're looking at this at a much different scale, both bigger scale and smaller scales. And I know this sounds a little abstract, but I guess part of what we try to do in the book is help understand the different ways we can be operating. And you know, cities and states are one construct, and nations, of course. But a lot of this has to do these days with airsheds and food sheds and watersheds, and that are more that may cross state or even national borders.
Right.
And so taking those different regional views, depending on whether they're big regions or little regions, is really a new way of thinking about how we make secure economies. By the way, one of the things that I really, you know, really struck me with this book is, and I hope that readers, even though we don't call this out explicitly in the book, implicitly, it makes you think about what does it mean to be secure? What does it mean to be prosperous? And, of course, what does it mean to be sustainable? Because security, for example, which is the one we talk about so much in during the election and in public discourse a lot, is usually about this threat and risk. And we talk about it more around resilience, resilience being defined as the ability to withstand shocks, or as Puck the Marine likes to say, the ability to take a gut punch and come back swinging.
Right.
But, you know, whether it's economic shocks or weather, severe weather shocks, or political terrorism, healthcare shocks, you know, disease vectors, whatever. Resilience is really what security is all about. And so we talk about keeping Al-Qaeda and ISIS and all that out of the country, and that's a really important thing, and we should not take our eye off that prize. But we also need to be looking inwardly and looking, understanding what does it mean to be secure as communities, as citizens, and of course as individuals, and ultimately that rolls up to what does it mean to be secure as a nation.
And looking at really big critical components of that, because another part of the book that really struck me, and it's so true, and it wasn't done in a blaming, accusatory way, but more of a inspirational way. At one point in the United States, our national security policy was crystal clear. We were, you know, get the bad guys, we're in this war, or whatever. And one of the challenges that you point out is what we were admired for so greatly is so disjointed now that nobody can even decide where the United States is going, let alone what it stands for, beyond preserving the status quo. That's another shift that has to happen. Would you put that as just a critical component in terms of how we can get from here to there?
Well, sure. I mean, the world's shifted a lot too. I mean, back in those days when it was much clearer, there was good. You know, the communists and the, you know, democracies, America's and its allies, and then some unaligned nations, and it was a bipolar, maybe tripolar world.
Right.
Now it's a multipolar, even an apolar world. There's just, you know, there's all kinds of different alliances. On any given day, we may be working with or against China, for example, or India, or, you know, the Middle Eastern countries. And so, you know, we're all frenemies. We're all cooperating and, you know, interdependent. And all those buzzwords that we use these days in business certainly apply to national security. And so thinking about how we can do that and how that rolls up into making us a stronger economy. I mean, there's a very direct, what was astonishing to me to learn in doing this was how much our national policy or foreign policy is aligned with our economic strategy. And I don't mean that in a conspiratorial, trilateral commission, military,
so
industrial.
Right.
Yeah, it's about how we protect ourselves from Soviet encroachment after World War II by building what was then called the Interstate Highway and Defense System, and that every bridge and overpass and tunnel is at least 14 feet high, which was designed to enable us to bring a truck with an ICBM on it, but also to disperse the population to outside the cities, which helped build the suburbs for better or for worse, and the car culture and the consumer culture, which we may look at now and say, well, that was unsustainable. But at the time, in the 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s, it made us strong and secure and helped us outcompete and ultimately kill the Soviet Union. And so what do we do this time in a way that is not the Soviet Union is the challenge? It's this thing called global unsustainability. That's what we tried to describe and articulate.
And there's actually, you know, I don't ever know if the pages in the book on my iPad correlate to what the actual book is, but there's a section in there that so clearly, adequately, and comprehensively describes what a consistent strategic behavior would look like. And what jumped out at me was, you know, that begins at home, and what we have to do for our, to create a new economic operating system. That was one of the things that was in it. Stop wasting our time about, you know, our emotionally and ideologically charged wedge issues, and taking things on in a very real way. And there's nothing I could think of that you have not mentioned in terms of, you know, education and getting our students educated so that they're up to the scientific challenges, skills training for our changing workforce. I mean, look at the workforce development, and we're going to have driverless cars, you know, and the beat goes on, and really, of course, comprehensively integrating education, public health, social service, and immigration policies to develop our national human capital to compete and lead in the global economy. That was one of my favorite paragraphs in the whole book. It's like, what do we have to do? This is what we have to do.
Yeah, and what we do, and what we really articulate in the book, and what the new grand strategy is all about, is simply that that our smart growth at home can become our smart power abroad. And so, how do we design an economy and domestic and foreign policies necessary so that our smart growth at home becomes our smart power abroad, which means that we're both growing and maintaining strong, economically strong and secure and resilient communities, and therefore, through that, being stronger in the world, both in terms of the enemies we encounter and the friends we want to influence.
So, in the closing moments, with that said, and that big, bold statement that you just made, it's like, show us how great we are by being great and doing those things again, that pride that all gets welled up in us when we sing, you know, the national anthem or something, that feeling is there. So for you personally, Joel McCower, what would your greatest hope be for the impact that this book can have on us and therefore the world? Yeah. What's your big dream of what it can do? Because it's big.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, I'm of an age where I was a conscientious objector in Vietnam War era, and you know, I don't come to patriotism or, you know, lightly or easily, and I, you know, maybe was dragged kicking and screaming even. I love my country. I feel really lucky that I was born here, but I was never, you know, one of these America right or wrong, and I'm still not. But this gave me a renewed hope. First of all, renewed perspective about what's possible, what we've done in the past to overcome diversity, and what happens when we come together and get our act together and act, you know, sort of under the guise of what we, our founders, laid out in the preamble of the Constitution. And it gave me a great sense of hope. And you know, I'm optimistic. The optimism I have in the world is really from the world of sustainability, actually, and all this great stuff I see. But this actually gave me a new sense of hope about our country, what's possible. And that's what I hope will, I hope that's what the reader will get. And I hope that through that, it might inspire some conversations. God knows at the national level would be great, but even at the regional, local, city level, about what's possible and what happens if we get things right. That would be my wish.
There's nothing better you could have said. It's about hope, possibility, and change, and that is my endorsement.
An opportunity. It's a massive opportunity here that we just is looking at us in the face, and we're not seizing it.
We need it. We so need this book. That's how I felt, because some of the shows I do are daunting, and I want to, you know, pull down the shades and crawl under the covers after what I've covered. And that, I mean, that's a real reaction. It's like, oh my gosh, I can't even handle it. There's no, you know, I'm in my third act. Yeah. So everybody, I just want to tell you in the last minute we have, the name of the book is The New Grand Strategy, Restoring America's Prosperity, Security, and Sustainability in the 21st Century. Take a step in the right direction for your life. Order the book, read it, share it with friends, and then write me a thank you note because I told you about it. So let's go to, that's blah, blah, blah. That's under the blah, blah, blah. You can find out more about greenbiz.com. I encourage everyone to sign up for their newsletter, their updates, subscribe to the blog. You can visit more about Joel at McCower.com. They're on Facebook and Twitter, Green Biz for Facebook. Joel has his own Twitter. It's twitter.com/McCower. Thanks, everybody. Make it a great green, consciously lived week. Joel, thank you so much for finally crossing Mrs. Green's world's path.
Thank you so much, Gina.
Thank you.